Guys, welcome to another episode of The Pulse. This one is a little bit different. So a lot of times you're used to some of the performers or entertainers, but the theme of the show is use your voice for good. And our guest today, Mr. Terrence Lewis, is somebody with a tremendous story, but kind of on the back end of that story has dedicated his life to using his voice for good. I appreciate you coming in.
I appreciate you having me again, Bill. Thanks for having me, man. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we're happy you're here.
Yeah.
You know, and we have a little bit of history, but our history starts late in your story.
True.
So, I don't know, is there an easy way to tell your story? You were obviously wrongfully convicted.
Yeah.
But how did that start?
Yes, and to answer your question, there's no easy way of telling it. You know, you just get right to it and tell it. It's the fact of the matter. It's the reality. At a young age of, as an adolescent at the age of 17, I was wrongfully accused and subsequently convicted of murder for a crime that I didn't commit. I did a total of 21 and a half years on a wrongful conviction on murder due to egregious police misconduct. It wasn't until 2019 when I was successful in actually being granted my full-blown exoneration and release. So, you know, the reality prior to 2019, my whole 20s and 30s and starting my 40s, I was incarcerated for murder.
You never, and some of the background is important, you never said, I did this. You never compromised. You never agreed to pleas.
No, never. The reality is, you know, an innocent man shouldn't, you know, succumb or to, you know, fabricate, you know what I mean, something that isn't in fact true. The reality is that, you know, I didn't commit the crime, but nonetheless, I was sentenced my natural born life to die in prison, you know, for the murder that I didn't commit. So, you know, as an adolescent, as a teenager, you know, walking around with that upon your shoulders, at, like I said, you know, yeah, that's a different burden to carry. That's a different mountain that had to be, you know, climbed. But nonetheless, you know, I did it. In regards to I climbed it, I'm on the other side of it, and you know, I'm grateful for that.
People, the immediate question, and I'm going to talk about how we first met, but the immediate question is, how does that happen? So there was, you know, and I know this is hard to revisit, but this is what you do. Like, you're sharing your story to try to make it better for other people.
Exactly.
Coming after you. You were convicted without physical evidence.
True.
No guns, no weapons, no. Nothing that connected you.
Exactly.
You were convicted based on the strength of the testimony of one person who admitted that they had used drugs, crack
cocaine,
moments before the incident
quote
happened.
Quote unquote, moments before it happened.
And then convicted largely because your nickname since childhood was Stink.
Exactly.
They said that the person who was involved in this had the nickname Stink.
Had a nickname Stink, yeah.
And that's essentially all the evidence that exists. There's no witnesses. There was no physical evidence. And that got you a murder conviction.
It got me a murder conviction. And it stripped me of 21 years of my life. Yeah, I was sentenced to life in prison based upon the testimony of an admitted crack user. Her words, quote unquote, she smoked crack cocaine moments before it happened, with numerous inconsistent statements and what she believed had transpired the night of the crime. But the reality is that during that time, during that era, the Philadelphia Police Department, the DA office at that time, that particular administration, they was gung-ho on just, you know, whatever cases was open to get them closed at whatever cost. So whatever that mean, and we call it, I guess, in a universal world, collateral damage. So that's how that administration, that's how that police department looked at it. You know, all right, he fit the mark, and if it wasn't him, he'd figure it out later, and if it was him, we got him. Because he do carry the same, they share the same name in common. They all look alike, that type. That was the atmosphere, and it really was. Again, like I said, earlier, you know, I made number six exoneree in the city of Philadelphia. We as a city are on now number 30 exonerees.
Just in the last couple of years.
Just in the last, I came home in 2019 and I made number six. So you look at, we in 2023 and we on number 30. And we're talking about people who literally, factually, physically, you know, did not commit the crime.
There were, at the time, that was all the evidence that we were aware of. And going back and doing the research of your case, you then find out what you took on the challenge, did all the appeals through your attorney, who, you know, there were questions about the abilities of the attorney at the time.
True.
You are sentenced to life, go into jail at 19, I believe.
Yes.
And took it upon yourself to just learn the legal system.
Absolutely.
And started defending yourself.
I did.
As that happened, you then find out that one of the people who was there at the crime that night said to their attorney, that's not him. I had never met that guy. I met him when we came to court together. And the attorney blocked that from getting into testimony.
You know, with that particular piece of evidence, which wasn't disclosed until literally almost a decade later, you know, probably about like, I want to probably say like 6-7 years later, that was some erroneous advice. However, I guess for whatever reason, for that attorney, he felt as though it was strategic for his client. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, he was wrong, because, you know, lives was lost, you know what I mean, at, you know, him shooting from the hip. And the reason why I say shooting from the hip is because this said attorney who we speaking of, the day that we initially start picking our jury was the day that he interviewed my co-defendant at that particular time. And when my co-defendant told him that, he just told him, well, you know, he wasn't prepared. He came in ready to just, you know, can he looking at the evidence and say, hey, it's obvious that this woman is lying, that she seen pink elephants that day, could have, right? So don't even worry about that. And you keep that to yourself. You don't have to, you know, that don't need to be utilized. But in turn, you know, he was wrong. He was gravely wrong.
I'm gonna keep progressing, because you know obviously this ends up, I guess, if you can call it a happy story, in that you didn't do life, but you did 20 plus years, you know, in prison. You went through the process of defending yourself.
I did.
Through various steps and appeals and state Supreme Court saying no and Supreme Court saying no and all
States.
Of these steps.
Yeah.
And then in what, 2009?
2009.
The judge said what?
Well, in 2009, like you said, to reiterate, after, at this point, countless, it was about two rounds of what we call going up the ladder. I was a pro se litigant immediately when I got off the bus, because I knew they were wrong. If no one else knew, I knew. So I immediately established my GED, and I took a correspondent course and became a paralegal and started to really learn the legalese, learn the jargon, because what was at stake literally was my natural life, right? And the attorneys that I had at the time, they were ineffective. I mean, effectively ineffective. I actually did from 2001 up to 2009 as a pro se litigant. And once I finally got to federal court, the Eastern District of Federal Court, I had a judge looked at my petition, you know, and she considered it on his merits, meaning for what it was worth, and said, all right, this guy's a pro se litigant. I hear what he's saying. I get what he's saying. And I'm going to appoint him an attorney. I'm going to appoint him an attorney to come, you know, orally, you know, state what I have written. And she did just that. So in 2009, upon my, what we call the evidentiary hearing, I got a hearing on what I was proclaiming and what I was asserting, right? And what I've been asserting since day one. Yeah. And she agreed with me. She unequivocally agreed with me. I had my pro bono attorney at that point, that was with the ninth year, right? Well, the 10th year, because in 1999 was the actual conviction. I spent 2 years from 97 in the county. The case happened in 96, right? So once he, this is how he stayed on the case. Mr. Dave Leger, I got to say his name, you know. Mr. Dave Leger, once the my federal judge said unequivocally, she said that I totally believe in your innocence, but due to the hierarchy in regards to how the system is set up, how it's rigged, right, how to keep you captive, she said that her hands was tied and she couldn't do nothing. So at that moment, Mr. Leger, he made a vow to me, he made an oath that he would continue to support me all the way through and through. And that's why I do what I do today, the work, because I want to give it back in regards to the experience and that help that I had. It's only right that I turn back and give it back.
So when I met you in met you,
yeah,
spoke with you on the phone in 2018, you provided the documentation from that judge.
Exactly.
So that judge said he was not there.
Yes.
He did not do this. I believe the testimony, but because of procedural and technical issues, sorry.
Yeah.
We can't let him out.
Cart before
so horse. So in 2009, judges are admitting you were innocent.
True.
You went back to jail for another 10 years.
That shattered my heart. There's a difference between having your heart broke and having it shattered. That shattered my heart. Yeah, in 2009, with a federal court order in hand, and we know, or at least we pride ourselves as a country in regards to, you know, once you get that order from the federal court, you know.
Right. Yeah, I finally learned. Yeah. I went to law school in prison. I was 17. I go through this whole process. Finally, I proved my innocence.
But due to the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, we call it the EADPA, which means basically it's like we don't care about the facts or the truth. Our law is more beneficial. It gets better or more appealing results. And I mean, in essence, you know, because like I said, we had a federal judge. We had, you know, even at this point, the state of Pennsylvania all started, you know what I mean, to see, like, I get the point. But they was going down kicking and screaming because their whole thing was, this is our job and we're just going to continue on with the flow. You know, business is normal. But nonetheless, that was the law. And sad to say, that is still the law till this day. It hasn't been repealed. So if you have concrete evidence, I'm talking about witnesses pointing, you have actual videotape showing that you was in Bogota, you was elsewhere. If you don't file it in a year's time, then it's irrelevant. That's law. You can Google this.
Even, and you're incarcerated doing this yourself. And I spent a lot of time on the background and getting to here, but I think it's necessary because people hear these stories. If we're being honest, you experienced it. I experienced it on the other side as media. People hear these stories, and a lot of people say, I didn't do it. A lot of people come to the table with their interpretation of, but I don't think that people firmly grasp in a situation like yours how much evidence can be on the side of the wrongfully accused.
Oh, absolutely.
And convicted.
Absolutely.
And they remain convicted.
Absolutely.
So you continued to fight this battle. We met and spoke to you while you were incarcerated in like 2018.
It was 2018. Yeah.
And I told people, thank God I listened to the letter. You've been writing to a lot of people.
I have. I wrote to President Bill Clinton. This was at the time when I really started writing. I wrote to Oprah. I wrote to CNN. I wrote to anybody who I thought had a voice and had some integrity, and you know, they stood on transparency and right is right, wrong is wrong, and I really don't care about the gray area. That's all I needed. That's what I needed. And everybody, for the most part, which is true, my cries fell upon deaf ears except for you. So I will be remiss if every time, you know, when the time presents itself, I gotta acknowledge that, because it's in the records. That's the reality. It's now part of my story, because that's the truth of the matter. So I thank you, man.
No, listen, I thank you for not letting us off the hook, like to keep writing the letters, because I can't imagine sitting here right now, now that I've met you and known you and you're out and living your life and helping other people, I can't imagine being the person who ignored that letter.
That would have been
in
nasty.
Hindsight.
Yeah, that would have been ill. That would have been like, no, seriously, you know, that was a grave mistake. I mean, at least we can write it off, I think, if I was in your shoes and if I had dropped the ball like that, from a moral perspective, I'd have been like, damn, man, like,
Listen, for me, and this isn't about me, but for me, the interaction with you was a reminder of the power that people have on the other side of the microphone or the camera, and please don't take it for granted.
That's right.
Yeah, and I remember talking to people that going, this guy really didn't do it.
Yeah.
And nobody's paying attention to the story. And it's, we're not nearly as helpless as you, but we were sitting back going, so now what? I mean, the judge already admitted, like, what can we do about it? So thank you for continuing fighting.
Thank you for the follow up. Meaning when you came to see, yeah.
So I'm in the hospital, side story, and then we'll keep going because you're doing great things. My mother's in the hospital at that time. I'm walking out of the hospital and you're standing in the lobby of UPenn Hospital.
Yeah.
And we had never met face to face. Like, we had interviewed while you were still incarcerated.
Exactly.
And we just kind of looked at each other like,
I'm like, that's Bill? Yeah. 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 And you knew, you noticed me, you know, yeah.
I was like, okay. Like, yeah. Context was hard.
Exactly. You put it right together, though.
It's like, you're out.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you kept fighting.
I did.
Got out.
I got out.
What was that like?
Oh, man, that right there, let's just be honest, allow me to be frank, right? I'm still, you know, reaping the benefits of that particular moment. I really am. It was so surreal. And mind you, that was 4 years ago. But if we doing the math, and depending on what measuring stick we measuring with, you know, I was away as a kid. I left as a kid, right? And I did 21 hard, excruciating years, right? For something I didn't do. Not just, you know, it wasn't no traffic violation I was wrongfully accused of. I was the cream of the crop. You know, they accused me of murder. So after walking that life, and then, you know, lo and behold, you know what I mean? Just, you know, being here on this side, you know, and being active and being free and, you know, feeling the air, smelling that fresh air, you know, being on this side, man, and being, you know, with my loved ones.
How did you do that? Like, I was telling my producer earlier today, I can't imagine a life sentence if I did it. I absolutely can't imagine hearing somebody sentence me to life when in my heart I know I didn't.
Yeah.
Like, at 17, 18, 19 years old, where'd you find the strength to not fold under pressure? Like, you fought the good fight and continue to fight it. I don't know that a lot of people have that in them.
Yeah, let me say this, right? That's a good point, because I have seen a lot of individuals, you know, succumb to that world. Honestly, I have seen people, you know, strive their best to cheat the state out of the time. I done seen guys, you know, mutilate themselves. I have. That's the reality. That's documented. You know, the fact that is in my DNA, and it is yours too. I wish that on no one, not even my worst enemy, you know. But the fact that, you know, I come from a long line of strong, you know, people, strong men and women. So, like I said, in my DNA, and the fact that my faith in God, honestly, man, you know, you can't do it. You can't walk through life, especially during a life sentence and living a life in that atmosphere without actually, you know, believing, you know what I mean, in a greater, higher power, you know, and that this cannot be in vain. That's what I used to always tell myself, that, you know, everything, you know, happens for a purpose. I couldn't identify.
Yeah. What's the purpose of this?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But a lot of individuals, mind you, I made number six, exoneree, in Philadelphia. We on number 30, and it ain't but a handful of us who's actually out here utilizing the opportunities when they knock on the door, the opportunity that you gave us. Hey, man, like, what's going on with you now? You're like, and watching the journey. And what are you doing now? You know, and how you feeling now with your mental and so on and so forth. So, yeah, but.
Man.
Yeah.
People, so we, the details of the story, the Supreme Court changed the rule as it relates to juvenile lifers. You had pretty much exhausted all of your appeals.
All of them.
That Supreme Court rule changed and got you in front of people again.
An honorable judge.
And that particular judge, you know, at that point they were like, maybe we'll resentence, and that's how you got out, because you wouldn't have been in front of a judge again if the rule for juvenile lifers hadn't changed and they were reviewing cases.
And that's what it was. That no, you absolutely right. You hit the nail on the head. The fact that when a crime occurred, when I was wrongfully accused and convicted, subsequently convicted of this crime, just so happened, you know, fortunately for me, it happened when I was an adolescent, when I was 17. So in 2012, the United States Supreme Court, they came out with a ruling saying that you cannot just throw away and discard the life of a juvenile, starting at 17 on down, 16, 15, you know, you got to give them a second bite at the apple if they have shown to be irreparable. I mean, if they shown some rehabilitation and they're not irreparable, right? Mm-hmm. And so my number came up to bat, because I could not give up my innocence, you know. So I watch individuals who honestly did their crime, being in the wrong place, wrong time, definitely, you know, showed remorse and shown the level of rehabilitation, right? Had 17 years in, 18 years in, go get resentenced, express their remorse to the court, and go on about their happy lives. And I'm sitting up here still continuing to rot away. And the only thing that my crime as of now it is that I continue to hold on to my innocence that we all agree upon. It's like, if you see the...
It's insane. And if you had simply said,
oh, yeah,
if you had lied,
yeah,
and said I did it.
Maybe, yeah, you could give him time served.
You could, right.
And got kicked out. And would have had the amenities of 2 years of housing vouchers. And I would have, the list would have been endless. No, for the most part, you know what I mean? All the programs, but that wasn't,
So you had to risk everything to fight.
I did. So because of that ruling, like you said, I went back to get resentenced. You know, I was the last one.
Right.
And then my judge... Oh man, Judge Barbara McDermott. I gotta say her name. Yeah, you just got to.
Yeah.
She looked at it, and she looked at it for its worth and its value. And she said, "Well, what is this here? What sentence do I suppose to give an innocent man? Is this the case?" And she read everything, and she wanted to ask the conviction integrity unit. Did y'all see this? I think y'all need to pay attention. And they had came aboard and said, no, we looking at it. We trying to find the judicial recourse. Because remember, the law is
right.
Not
what
in
can
our
we legally do.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, the right way. So, you know, he got to, you know, take his course. And being an honorable judge and having jurisdiction in her courtroom of the jurisdictional matter, she looked at it and she did what she was supposed to do, what she took an oath to do, and she ruled accordingly. And then the rest is history.
That's how you got out. And even that ended up being, I mean, not luck, but the appeals were exhausted. So that that's why you got out.
Yeah.
Maintained your innocence the entire time.
We all call it, Bill, I got to say this, mm-hmm. And you got to share the belief. We call it, you know what I mean, it was miraculous. It was a miracle. I mean, honestly, because had they didn't, and had I wasn't, and had if the pieces didn't line up the way they lined up at the right time, oh, that's for certain. That's
well, and so, okay, so that's most of the story. Then you get out. When people are wrongfully convicted in Pennsylvania and spend no matter how much time, you get out with nothing.
Get
they say, my bad, sorry about that. You're now at, there's no compensation, there's no housing, there's no training, there's nothing.
It's nothing, zero.
So they let you out after keeping you incarcerated for 20 plus years, and now you're out, but essentially homeless, unemployed, and still trying to clear up the fact that if people search your name, they see murder conviction.
Exactly. That's exactly the case. And add in the fact that, you know, the only means, you know, a resource, you know what I mean, was and I appreciate the greater good of Philadelphia, you know what I mean, in regards to, and others around, surrounding areas in our state and wherever else it came from in regards to a GoFundMe. You know, that's what they left me with, you know, and that was it.
It's a crazy story. All right. So you get out, sue the city, win a settlement. We're not going to go into the details of all of that, but you win the settlement against the city, which was another indication that you had been wrongfully, you know, sentenced and convicted for 20 plus years and win a significant settlement.
Yes.
But I don't know what's significant when you've been incarcerated for 20 some odd years for something you didn't do.
That's true. No money, allow me. No money that I know of. And I'm just saying it from a practical standpoint. And, you know, like you said, you know, without even having to disclose, you know what I mean? I was given, a check, right? And that check doesn't heal the wounds. It really don't. It don't soothe or mend them scars, you know what I mean, that was placed upon throughout that journey, you know. Granted, it was a startup kit for me to start putting the pieces of my life back together. Because, mind you, when I was incarcerated, as a lifer, you're not given the access and the amenities of things that the tools and the resources which will be needed to make your life sustainable, you know what I mean, and successful once you do reenter back in society.
Their goal to get out.
Exactly. Their goal, look, you're a lifer. You're going to die in jail, so you don't get to go to HVAC. You don't get to go to carpentry class. You can't be a welder. And when they did have these programs, there's no benefit to you. You got to at least be 2 years out from your minimum to even be able to sign up for these type of programs. So for me, you know, I was just, one pushing a broom. So that's what my life would have been molded as, a broom pusher. Well, I'm just saying, like, damn. Right. 21 years behind the eight ball. It's inflation. Like, it's 2020. It's 2019. I left in 1999. You know, technology, the whole world done changed. But
there's so much to this story. I feel like we could do a couple of shows. But I do want to touch on. You got out. You get the settlement, and immediately you start taking some of that settlement. You start your foundation.
True.
Tell us about the foundation.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, so in the spring of 2020, what's 8 months after my release, due to a childhood friend of mine being wrongfully accused as well, wrong place at the wrong time, as well as countless other individuals that I done encountered in my life throughout my stay. Like I said, I can hang my hat on survivor's guilt. I can say, you know, morally speaking, it was only right that I pay it back forward by not just, you know, in speech, you know, with being an advocate on their behalf, you know what I mean, but indeed as well. So what my goal was, the experience that I was blessed to have with Mr. Leger in 2009, that the next 10 years I had that help and assistance. Mm-hmm. So I knew what it took, you know, to get me to become here. You know, I needed that help, because after the first 10 years, you know, pro se, it was a tough battle, but nonetheless it was done and I accomplished that. So that help meant everything. So what I wanted to do, I wanted to start, you know, advocating on behalf of Pennsylvanians, you know, and I wanted my mission to be a twofold mission. I wanted to advocate on behalf of Pennsylvanians to get them home first and foremost, and then provide them with the necessary resources to keep them home. And that's exactly what I did. So I established, I founded in the spring of 2020, the Liberation Foundation. The acronym TLF, and like I said, is the twofold mission. In a nutshell, I started two initiatives. The first one being Project RIC, which is an acronym for Research, Investigate, and Compile. And I went around galvanizing, UPenn students and Temple students and Georgetown law students to basically cut out the administrative work for an attorneys so that a pro bono attorney or a low bono attorney would have the time in their day to look at these cases, that definitely need another eye looked at. So, but at once that happens, and I have been successful, with establishing that.
We've been successful in getting people out.
Exactly. Yeah. Where do we go from there? Because I remember I just came out, and I know, you can't just leave an individual after doing 20, 30 years. Sometimes individuals prove their innocence after 40 years or a commutation. They need that extra assistance, the stability of employment, as well as, transitional, housing or the ABCs of housing. Get a living quarter. You do what I'm saying? And then get a better one. And then you get the condo and all that. So point being is that's basically what we're doing now with the foundation, twofold mission, getting individuals home and providing them with the necessary resources and keeping them home. And right now, this phase that I'm about to embark upon and collaborating, Pete Williams, right, from Extreme Choices, we collaborating with DOC, is we beefing up our pre-preparation reentry program, providing individuals so that when they get here, you don't have to figure out exactly what you need to do. You should already know that. It goes back to that old saying that it's better to have an opportunity. It's better to be prepared and not have an opportunity than, have an opportunity and not be prepared. So that's basically what we're doing now.
People can get more information, and we're going to do more going forward. I wanted to spend time to reconnect, make sure people are aware of the story, make sure people know how to get in touch with you and support the foundation. And just, man, just to catch up.
That's like, right,
it's,
man.
When we started doing this show, and I'm going to leave it there because we could keep talking.
True.
When we started doing this show, it's interesting because I was putting together a list of people with my producer who's sitting over there. Putting together a list of people that we wanted on The Pulse. It was our wish list. Like, we didn't even have a show. It was the wish list of people. And there were a lot of, I wonder if Janet Jackson's available. We kind of went through the list. And you were one of the people who was on it. And it wasn't that long of a list. It was, people need to hear this story so that hopefully it has the same impact on them that it did, on us.
Absolutely.
And the lives that you've changed. And, I appreciate the fact that you've come and continue to share your story and the work that you're doing.
Appreciate you too, Bill, for having me and for using your voice to give the opportunity for individuals similarly situated as myself or who have, a story to tell such as myself to be able to present it, use their platform, the collaboration type thing. So I'm glad that, my cries, and my seeking out to you and your, help needing your assistance didn't fall upon deaf ears. I really did. Like I said, I feel as though you, from amongst others, was a catalyst to allow me to get my story out there, so that it started picking up momentum and it got into, it became known, for the most part locally, so that individuals who were stakeholders and helping righting the wrong that happened to me did such. Honestly, it happened like that, in that order.
20 years in, now 4 years out, you're already changing lives. But when you hear that, I do the same thing. You just went, phew.
Yeah.
20 years in, but now 4 out. And so a lifetime ahead to continue to make positive change. Thank you, man.
You got to have me back on the show, man. I got to come back here. I got to let you know, allow me to do some more groundwork, you know, make some more progress. So build from there, you know.
That's a yes. Absolutely. We will absolutely do that.
All right.
Guys, thanks so much for listening to the Pulse with Bill Anderson podcast. Yes, I am aware that today's show was a little bit different. It was a story that had meaning. It was a story that had impact. And it was a story from a person whose name you may not have been familiar with, but you should be, because it is a story that, unfortunately, is happening in the shadows way too often across our country. So I hope you enjoyed the information. I hope that you will follow his foundation and get a little bit more information about how we can all get involved in trying to initiate some real change as it relates to the topics that he was discussing. Do me a favor, look on your screen, your phone, your tablet, and click that little button that says subscribe, follow, like, whatever it is that will get you a notification every Monday when another episode of The Pulse comes out. You also can head over to YouTube, do a little search of The Pulse with Bill Anderson, and see so many guests that have been on the show that you may not have gotten a chance to check out. Go ahead and look back. It's been hard to believe, over a year now of what I think are some great guests. And you can hit me up on social media at BillAFox29. Always eager to hear from you. I leave you today, as I always do, reminding you whenever you can, use your voice for good, like Terrence Lewis is now doing, and have a good one.